Welcome to Inside Jag Nation, a weekly podcast that gives you an in-depth look at the South Alabama Jaguars. You can find a new podcast uploaded weekly online at usajaguars.com or take the podcast with you on your smartphone by subscribing for free on iTunes. Just search South Alabama Jaguars.
We're here with this week's edition of the Inside Jag Nation podcast, the weekly look into administrators, coaches, student athletes within the University of South Alabama Athletic Department. I'm Associate Athletic Director for Media Relations, Brian Freeman, and joining us this week is head baseball coach Mark Calvi. Coach, thanks for taking the time to sit down with us.
Glad to do it, Brian. Thanks for having me.
The baseball program will start fall practice next week, running into the Red-Blue series later into the fall, and I wanted to ask a few questions about that whole season, which is entirely different than the spring when you got 50-something games and conference and NCAA tournaments on your agenda. How much do you look forward to this time of the year where you go from where you can practice with individuals and small groups to getting the full team out there?
Well, I look forward to the fall. I always have, basically because there's no – wins and losses. You know, your main priority is to get a look at some of the new guys, see where they might fit in the spring, knowing that what you see in the fall and what you get in the spring sometimes are two different things. And it's a chance to see your returners and some of the things that they've worked on over the summer and some of the things that you have, you know, as a coach have worked on with them as players as far as getting better. So the main focus is development and really staying healthy, guys getting strong and avoiding any injuries, but getting your work in. So we've had extremely productive falls here, and this fall should be no different. We backed it up a little bit to October 10th. Usually we start around September 17th through the 20th, and we backed it up a bit because we have 11 new pitchers, and we had a bunch of guys that went out and played summer ball, and so we gave them a little bit of rest on the front end, and all these new pitchers kind of getting used to their surroundings and the system and the weight room and doing things like that. And so we moved it back, and we're looking forward to it. We crank it up the 10th, and which is right around the corner, and we're excited about it.
So as I mentioned before, it's not like this is the first time you're going to see the guys on the field. You've been able to work with groups of four and individuals. When you have that situation versus fall practice coming up, what do you do in those sessions when you have the kids on the field? How's it structured?
Well, you know, we do big groups of optional live hitting on the field. We probably hit on the field batting practice more than anyone. We really do. And then we spend a lot of our time on the defensive side of the ball where we meet with the groups and you know, Coach Lucky has the infielders. This year, the NCAA changed the rules where it's not four-on-ones. You can have as many guys out there at a time as you'd like, as long as you don't exceed your hours per person in a week. So we're still very defensive-oriented around here, and pitching and defense wins you baseball games. It really does. And we do our offense around that, you know, our groups. And we have guys – this has been a different group in that, you know, our kids – right now we have two guys hitting in the cages in the morning before classes, and we'll have 3 to 5 guys in the morning. And I'll have guys texting me and the other coaches at night to come out and throw some BP at night. So we have a pretty motivated group. And, you know, we have a lot of returners offensively, which makes me feel good. So it's not like we have to put in everything with this new group. So, you know, we've gotten a lot of work out of our individual skill groups, and they're fired up for the fall to start.
You know, we touched on before about the, you know, you lose a large number of letter winners, including about 10 pitchers from last year. And, you know, obviously you get a look at new guys and you see what the old guys coming back have done, whether they're better, same, worse. How many answers do you think you come out of fall practice with of, okay, I've got these guys, and how many answers do you think you get in January when preseason practice starts?
That's a good question. It's a hard question. It really is, because the fall, and it's kind of the joke, it's kind of the running joke in college baseball, in that you know, the fall, it's something that you have to do. But I really don't know how much you learn. I don't know how much you learn about your guys because – and I say that from a developmental standpoint, from a team standpoint, from a camaraderie standpoint, from a teamwork standpoint, it's extremely important because you put in a lot of your team defenses. It's a lot of it's a lot of team-oriented things. But I've seen guys that go out and they put up great numbers in the fall, whether it be offensively or on the mound. And you think you really have something, and you think that this guy might be better than what we thought he was, and the spring rolls around, and sometimes you get a little different product. So the fall can be deceiving in terms of success or failure. On the flip side, I've also had guys that they've looked absolutely horrible in the fall. Randy Bell couldn't get through an inner squad last year without us flipping sides or him reaching his pitch limit, and we're like, wow, he doesn't quite look the you know what we thought he was going to be, and then here he goes, he's one of the better pitchers in the country. I remember in the fall of 2008, we had a kid named Nick Ebert at South Carolina, and Nick was one for the fall, and he got one hit. He was like 1 for 50, and then in the spring, I think he got one more hit, so he was 2 for about 100, but that was before the real game started. He didn't play a whole lot for the first 2 weeks, and after that, he ended up hitting 21 home runs and like 80 RBIs, and the rest is history. He was a 10th round draft pick by the New York Yankees. So I go into the fall. I'm very objective. I want to see what guys can do. I want to see how they can help the team. Can guys run? Are they nervous when they have the green light? Can they bunt? Can they sack bunt? Can they bunt for base hits? What pitchers, can handle some pressure in an inner squad setting. And so what you learn is limited, but it is still extremely important. There's only, and you ask any baseball coach this, there's only so much you can learn about your team or about a player when you're playing your own team. You really see who a team is and who a player is when you're playing somebody else, and you know, when the fire gets hot, and as they say, iron sharpens iron, you know. So we try to promote a very competitive atmosphere, especially in inter squads and on a daily basis. And we try to keep things as game like and as competitive like as far as games go as we can. And still, with all that being said, there's only so much you can learn about an individual in the fall when all you're doing is playing inter squads.
When it comes to the fall season, tell us how you set it up. How much is a practice that, like, a lot of us probably remember when we were growing up going through high school, where it's more instructional and drills versus scrimmages, live batting versus pitching? How do you break that down?
Well, because we backed up the fall a little bit more this fall, our pitchers are a little more ready to go out and throw two innings. So instead of come here, throw your three or four pins, and then in 3 weeks, you know, as soon as school starts in 3 weeks, we're starting the fall. Like I said earlier, we've given them more time. So I feel as though our pitchers are more prepared to go a little bit longer, at least go out there and throw 30 to 40 pitches their first time out instead of 15. So we have done a lot of our instructional information on the front end in the last 4 to 5 weeks. So what we'll do, we'll go October 10th through roughly November 20th, and we'll inter-squad on Tuesdays, Fridays, Saturdays, and Sundays. We'll try to get out there 4 times and play inter-squad games. And the Tuesday game could be a 5-inning ball game, and the weekends could be 3 7-inning games. And I'm not super concerned with, you know, with going 9 innings all game for all our games. I'm really not. As long as we get our work in, we get our at-bats in, and we see some of the pitchers do some things that they're going to have to do in the spring. So our fall practice will consist of 4 days where we inter squad, and I'll probably give them Mondays and Wednesdays off. So Tuesdays we'll practice, we'll do some fundamental work, probably some defensive fundamental work, and then we'll hit on the field. We'll put in some things offensively that we like to do in the spring and that we want to see our guys execute in some fall games, and we'll probably play a 5-inning inter squad on Tuesday. And like I said, I'll give them probably Wednesday off, and then we'll practice Thursday. And then we'll get ready for the weekend, and we'll play Friday, Saturday, Sunday. In going 7 innings, that gives us about a half-hour window to 45 minutes to you know, we can cover something that we might have done incorrectly, either from an offensive or defensive side. So we'll have a window to practice there before an inter-squad game. So it's not going to be just play over, you know, games over development. It's going to be we'll go back and correct and teach and do and go over some things that maybe that we think we need some work in. But really, it'll give these kids a chance, especially the new guys. It'll give these kids a chance, enough opportunities to show us why we recruited them or why they're here. So, and it also, from a competitive standpoint, it's really good. They get excited to play the inter-squad games. But the luster can wear off if you do it too much, or if you go too long, it can wear off in about week three. So that's why the two off days in there are important, and that's why not staying out there for 4 hours per inter-squad day is important as well. We try to keep it, you know, under 7 to 8 innings per day, and so we can get a lot of work in, and we can back it up day in and day out.
When you get into these scrimmages, how do you work the teams? Is it you change it up by week? You change it up by day? Do you set them up to where you're looking for certain people to match up against others, hitters, pitchers? Or is this more about, you're on this team this day because you just want to see them in a game-type environment?
We do that sometimes. The teams will change up. It's not like one team plays the other team and that's what you stay with. I know you're very familiar with our program, especially the last couple of years. We've had some versatile players where we've had and it's by design. We do that on the front end from a recruiting standpoint. We try to make sure we always have enough depth on the infield. With that being said, we'll have guys that play infield and outfield. Last year, you have Adam Wolf that can play second, first base, right, left. He could probably play center. Brendan Donovan can play left and first, left and right field. We've had some catchers that we've slid out to the outfield. So we've had some versatile guys. We've had infielders that, you know, your shortstop. If you're playing short for us, you're going to know how to play second base. If you're playing second base, you're probably going to learn how to play third base and vice versa. We have a couple guys out there that are at third right now that also play some at short. That would be some depth guys for us at short. So, yes, we will stack some teams where, okay, we want to see these. I want to see this left-handed pitcher get out this left-handed lineup. So we can customize how we want to, you know, who we want to see face who and what hitters to face left-handed pitching and so on. But we will move guys around depending on basically teaching them new positions and having them become familiar with every position in the infield that they may play. It does take a little bit longer. It's a little more arduous in terms of teaching and instruction. But I think, you know, Coach Lucky does an absolutely fantastic job, and Coach Prothrow with the outfielders does a fantastic job in moving guys around and teaching them different positions. So that's why, you know, a couple of years ago, Drew Labonte went down with shoulder surgery and Ryan Raspino stepped in and fielded 970. We've been able to move, you know, Adam Wolf from right field into second base and when someone's twisted an ankle and then back out to left field. And where some other teams, they lose their guy, they don't have enough depth, or they have to teach somebody a new position 30 games into the season, it can be detrimental to your success. So we try to do a lot of that on the front end. We try to look at the worst case scenario, and that's some of your infielders going down. Who's the backup, and who can play multiple positions? And it's boded well for us in the past.
And I imagine, you know, just across all levels of baseball, how much that must help you when you've got, because some teams your backup infielder is a guy that's going to hit 150, might be a good glove, but when you have flexibility and versatility, your offense likely is not nearly to take a hit like that, I would imagine.
No, that's true. That is true, but my philosophy is, and it has been for a long time, you recruit that which you cannot manufacture. You can manufacture offense. It's not about being the best overall hitting team. We'd love to have that. It's about being the best team on the mound and the best team defensively, because if you don't have a good center fielder, you're not manufacturing that guy during the year. If you don't have good infielders, there's no way in a game you can manufacture good defense or good pitching or good catching. You just can't do it. You can manufacture offense. So you might be in a position where you have some backup guys in there, and you're not at your best offensively. But the team that you're playing might not be the best on the mound that day. So they might, their pitching staff might walk five or six, and they might make two errors. Well, you can manufacture some things. You can hit and run. You can safety squeeze. You can suicide squeeze. You can take some pitches to work the count and kind of let the other team beat themselves. Where we don't want to be caught in a situation where we are beating ourselves or we cannot make routine plays. So, yes, it would be great to be solid in all three, pitching, defense, and offense. And that's our goal every single year when we recruit. But ultimately, we are always going to recruit against our worst nightmare, and that's not having enough guys on the mound, good pitchers, and not having enough good infielders, not having enough good defenders. And I think some teams – I think that we've caught some teams and we've pulled ahead of them because it could be philosophical in recruiting. It's just the way that I've done it before here and when I got here. And, you know, it's helped us when we've had some injuries. It really has. We've been able to plug in some guys that we recruited that, you know, maybe when you look at it, you're like, okay, we're good enough. We can stop recruiting now. And we just kept going, and we try to have as many good guys in here as we can that can play defense, and the offense will figure itself out if we're talented enough. We know that our guys are going to work hard enough, and we're going to coach them up the right way to where we can manufacture some offense if we need to throughout the course of the season, whether it be better base running, whether it be stealing bases, dirt ball reads, little things in the game that really aren't taught that I think our coaches do a really good job of stressing the importance to our players and the importance of that in winning and losing a ball game.
I'd like to go now and actually kind of talk about the early days for you. When you remember first playing baseball, was it the first sport you played? Is this something that you've kind of always had a love affair with going back to when you were a little kid?
No, not really. I was born in my whole family's from the Boston, 20 minutes from Boston in Massachusetts. And we moved to South Florida when I was five in 1973. But I was in I was playing peewee hockey at three. I was up on skates and I was in a league at 3, 4 years old. I hadn't thrown a baseball. I hadn't played baseball. I didn't think about playing baseball. I actually didn't start playing baseball till I was eight and a half years old, which by today's standards, parents would laugh at you. They're like, you started playing baseball when you're eight. Kids now they're playing little league and they're on travel teams at five and six. It's insane the way these kids are playing nowadays and how much and how early they're playing. Back in the early 70s, early to mid 70s, it was different. We played multiple sports, and my family was in transition. We moved down and we had three kids, and my dad was transitioning into another job, and and my mom stayed at home. She was a housewife. So think in terms of them getting, you know, their feet situated as parents, you know, with us smaller kids. My brother was one and I was four. My sister was seven. We moved down to South Florida at the time. And there really wasn't a whole lot of time to take Mark to Little League practice. So I just ran around. I did what a lot of other kids did. I ran around. We played pickup games. And I'm like, okay, well, I remember when we first moved down to Florida, I had a hockey stick and a plastic puck, and that's what I shot around until I met some kids in the neighborhood, and that's what I did. That's what I knew. That was a sport I was playing. So, and then really, I loved football, so I started playing football. We were in, you know, tackle football league, especially down in Florida. Football is huge, and they start them young. So I was playing tackle football at six and a half, and then it wasn't until the next cycle where I came back in at eight and got into baseball. And I played different sports like everyone else. I played basketball, and I had the hoop in the driveway and shot hoops in between football games and baseball games. But I played both. I played football growing up, and I played baseball growing up all through high school. And then I was probably recruited more to play football out of high school than I was baseball. Back in the mid-'80s, so I graduated in 86, it was nothing to not be recruited until the spring of your senior year. No one panicked. It's kind of how they did it. And, so back then I received some baseball interest in my junior year, and I got some letters from some schools, but it was mainly more for football. It really was. And I remember I got a letter. I was in my senior year, and I got a letter from my first Division I football program, which was East Carolina. I had some smaller schools, and I got a letter from East Carolina, and I started paying a little more attention to college football when that came in. And I was looking at the size of these guys, and I was 5'8", 185, and I could run a little bit, but not like the way they could run. And I had a come to Jesus moment, because I was considering doing both, playing football and baseball, or maybe just football. I didn't know which one I was going to specialize in. So I actually had a chance to sit down and pay a little bit more attention to the way the big boys played football. And I watched. I remember it was a Saturday, and I was watching, I think it was Indiana versus Michigan. And even though I wasn't recruited by either one of those programs to play football, I'm like, these are the type of guys that I'm going to have to go up against if I go play Division I football. And it became very, very obvious to me that baseball was probably the path that I needed to go down in terms of college, and if I wanted to play past high school. And so I started to emphasize the sport more. And I always worked hard at it, but it was then – It was early in my senior year that I said I really need to take this baseball thing serious and try to make this work and try to play college ball. And back then we had ESPN, but you only saw college baseball when it was the College World Series, when they filmed, you know, when they had it on TV at the end of the year. So we weren't exposed. College football was everywhere, not like it is now, but in terms of back in those days it was on all the time. College baseball was it was something that you heard about, but not a whole lot. Maybe you read the papers, but it wasn't televised. So it's not as sensationalized as it is now, which is good for the sport, I think. But there wasn't a whole lot of awareness brought to college baseball, which is why I was at 5'8", 185, considering playing Division I football when I got a letter and I was starting to be recruited. So I realized quickly I was out of my mind for even considering that. And I started to wonder why they even considered me because of my size, but it really helped me in terms of narrowing my focus and what I wanted to do in college, and that was play baseball. And I was fortunate enough where I did that, and I had the good fortune of being able to sign professionally. Dan Jennings, a scout from this area, ended up signing me back in '91, and I played with the Seattle Mariners for a little bit. And I'm glad I took that route because it's responsible, really, that day. And deciding to put my focus into baseball is, you know, you look back and you trace your steps and you say, well, how did I get here? And that was probably the first, you know, epiphany that I had in terms of, you know, that light coming on going, okay, this is what I want to do and let's go after it. And I can trace my steps back from sitting here with you right now doing this interview, and that's probably the reason why I'm here. And a lot of things happened from then to now, but me coming to that decision put me in positions to meet certain people and that help you along the way and ultimately help form you and help you get where you're at today. And I'm extremely thankful that I made that decision.
Well, our fans are obviously well aware of college baseball, the landscape, not just in the Sun Belt, but across the Southeast and this program's history. Tell me about the difference of minor league baseball versus college baseball. What stands out to you is kind of the major differences that people might not see without being behind the scenes?
A serious college baseball program it's as good as most of these kids will ever get it. It's not like I played 5, 6, 7 years of minor league baseball, but I was there long enough to know that it is not the environment. It really is a different ball game in terms of just the overall culture of it. And I love professional baseball, but I was in my early 20s at the time when I signed, and I was ready for that. I had been around the block a few times. You know, I wasn't a 19-year-old kid anymore, and I was ready to go out and play professional baseball. A lot of these kids that are 19, 20 years old, they are not ready for the type of life that you lead. It's every man for himself. There really is no team concept. It's you kind of play for your numbers, and so you can move up. There's not a lot of shoulders to cry on if you need something or you have some concerns or some difficulties in life. It's you know, the strong will survive, and you have to be disciplined enough to live the lifestyle, and that's, you get done late at night, and you know, you can sleep in till 1 in the afternoon, and you can show up at the park and do it all over again for 170 games. So it takes a lot of discipline to be the right person and live the right way, eat the right way, sleep the right way. And a lot of these kids, they struggle with that. They can't do it. And you're away from home. You're on your own a lot. And you could be one for your last 32, and you're staring down an 11-hour bus ride and a 7-day road swing. Whereas here, there's some breaks in the action. You have, you know, it's all about what they do here. It's about being good here. It's about helping this program win. It's not about moving up to the next level and getting out of A ball so you can get the double A, or getting out of double A so you can be in triple A, or getting out of triple A so you can be in the big leagues. This is about, you know, getting a great education and playing a team sport, which is baseball, at a high level at an extremely competitive program. And, you know, I tell guys all the time that this is as good as you'll have it until you're ever lucky enough to make it to the big leagues. They won't get it any better than this. Maybe triple A and you play in the nicer stadiums and you fly, but the way we travel, the way these guys are treated, and from the strength and conditioning to just the lifestyle, it's completely different. So, you know, when you look at it, it's called baseball, but it really is. It's professional baseball. It's college baseball. They are two different lifestyles and two different games, and it's the kids, you know, that can handle that and that have the self-discipline, like Jordan Patterson, and you have to have the talent as well. But those are the guys that tend to rise to the top, and I mentioned him. We're extremely excited about him. He was called up to the major leagues a month ago, and he's doing well. But it's a very, very tough industry to be in. It really is. And when you look at the numbers that actually make it, the kids that actually get drafted in a pro ball, it's a small in terms of the kids that are playing baseball every year. The numbers are against you. The percentages of kids that actually sign a professional contract is small, and it's even smaller the kids that make it to the big leagues. It's almost impossible to make it to the big leagues, and then it goes down even more. The numbers are even against you more, that you'll never have to use your degree to work or to find a job, that you'll actually make enough playing baseball. It makes you wonder why we ever even get in this game. Why do we start playing it when we're 6 years old, and in my case 8, and running around and putting all the time in? But it's the greatest game in the world. It really is. And but the professional and college game are two different ball games and two different lifestyles, and you have to be a certain type of guy to handle the grind of the day in and day out, and the failure, because it revolves around failure. It really does, especially hitting. Hitting revolves around failure, and you have to be able to handle that and make it work for your advantage. And but the guys that actually handle the game the right way are developing life skills at the same time, whether they know it or not, and it prepares you for some ups and downs of life. The game of baseball, it really does.
So when you finished your playing career, before you got into coaching, you actually spent time as a professional scout. Again, one of those compare contrast questions for you. Compare being a scout, what you did, what you look for, versus being a coach.
I was fortunate enough when, you know, there's a couple times in your life when you're really, really confused. And one of those is either when you're done with college or you get released. You know, that was the first time. I remember figuring where to go to college was a confusing time for me, because I was 17 years old. And then at 25, when my baseball career was over, I was as confused as I've ever been. It's like, okay, what now? It's you've linked yourself, you've hitched yourself to a game, and you know, it starts to become your identity. It's what you identify with. It becomes, you're a baseball player, and that's what you do. And when I was told that my playing career was over, It was hard. It really was. It was hard. And I was married at the time. I remember it was spring of 93, and I came home, and it really is. It's the question. It's what now? And I had some aspirations of going to law school or maybe getting into education or law enforcement. And it was really what now? And the local Seattle Mariners scout had given me a call, and he said, listen, I saw you got released, and you know, I put your name in to be a coach in the organization, and they'd like for you to coach. And I've also put your name in to be a scout when the next hiring cycle comes up. And he said, but in the meantime, unless you want to continue playing, I'd like for you to help me and, you know, maybe drive around the state of Florida and help me scout and you know, maybe get some experience in case the job opens up in the organization. And his name was John Ramey, and I thought it was a great idea. My wife wasn't too thrilled about it at the time because I was gone a lot, but I thought it was a pretty good idea. And at that point, you have to understand, I wasn't growing up, you know, going, okay, I'm going to be a coach. You know, I'm going to play baseball, and then when I'm done, my whole life's going to be baseball. That wasn't the plan. I don't remember. I didn't have a clear plan, but I knew that wasn't it. I wasn't against it. It just wasn't in my mind. That's what I was going to do. And like I said earlier, there are certain people that you meet where you can trace your steps and see where you're at. Certain people that helped you and molded you along the way, whether you knew it or not. And that was one of those times. And I realized that, you know, I realized how important the game of baseball was to me. Even though now I wasn't a player, I realized that I felt like I could have something to give to the game and I could be pretty good at it if I worked at it. And I was no stranger to that, to working at something. So that's how it started. It really did. That's how it started. And I also had there was a scout in the Rockies organization who coached me in college named Pat Jones. And he stayed on me. He's like, you really need to stay in the game. I'm going to push to have you stay in the game, and I'm going to stay on you until you decide to stay in the game. And, you know, whatever you decide to do, I'll love you anyways, but you need to stay in it. In some capacity, you need to stay in it. And he was really one of my first real baseball coaches. He was kind of a mentor to me in the game of baseball. And he was one of the only people that I really listened to. And I'm like, well, here's a guy that, you know, that I look up to and have a lot of respect for, and he's telling me that he thinks I should stay in the game. Maybe I need to consider this. And that's what I did. And then John Ramey gave me an opportunity to help him scout. And I'm very thankful to Dan Jennings, who was the scout that signed me. He actually lives here in Mobile. I see him quite frequently, which, small world. You know, you trace your steps back 25 years ago, and here we are. I live 30 minutes away from the guy that signed me. But there's a lot of people that helped me along the way, and Pat Jones kind of convinced me that it would be good for me to stay in the game, and that's what I did. And I was fortunate enough to have an opportunity to scout a little bit before I got into coaching at FIU with Danny Price. And John Ramey and Pat Jones were two of the people that helped me get hired at FIU. So, you know, and here we are today doing this interview. So there's just a lot of important people in my life that helped me along the way with the decision to be where I'm at now.
Is there anything that from that time as a scout you use today in the recruiting process?
Not really, because the recruiting back then, you know, when scouts do it differently than recruiting, there is no relationships with the players. You either like them or you don't. You put them down. They'll either sign for a certain amount of money where you see them slotted, or they won't. There is no recruiting and get a relationship with them, and it's kind of a cold job, really, because you don't have relationships with the players. You don't need to have relationship with the kids that you're scouting. In college, it's about developing relationships with the coaches and the players, and you know, convincing them that your program and is the right place for them, and you're the right person for them. Whereas, you know, Major League Baseball is Major League Baseball. You either want to go out and sign or you don't. It's okay either way. With us, you know, we need that guy, that certain guy that we're on, or guys that we're on hard to want to come our way, because odds are they're being recruited by other schools if they're good enough for us to be recruiting them. So, but really what I learned, it wasn't from the recruiting standpoint. From an evaluation standpoint, that's when I started to learn some things, what to look for in certain players and what not to look for, the red flags and the things that you know, that should pique your interest. So I'm very fortunate that I had my time with the Mariners and with John Ramey from a scouting aspect, because it helped me from an evaluation standpoint.
Leads me into my next question, and you brought it up. So when you are on the road recruiting, what are you looking for? What qualities in an individual do you want to see for the people you want to bring to the University of South Alabama?
Well, it depends on what your needs are. Every year your needs might change. But I'll go back to what I mentioned to you earlier. I'm always going to recruit what you can't manufacture. I'm going to recruit against facing down your worst nightmare, and that's not having enough good pitching and not having enough good infielders and catchers. So if ever I have a doubt, if it's down between who do I sign, a hitter or a really good pitcher, I'm going to go the pitcher route. With that being said, what I look for, at our park, South Carolina is a little bit different because, the outfield was small, so we didn't need really fast guys in the outfield. We needed guys that could hit and hit it out of the ballpark. We needed guys that could make the routine play but could really hit. Here, I need that as well, but I need guys that can run because the park is big. And it plays big sometimes, especially to center and right field. So my center fielder and right fielder really need to be able to go get the ball. Left field, when the wind's blowing out, it'll play small. You don't need to have your best defender out there. But for us, we're going to have to always be able to run. So I'm looking for outfielders that can run and do some things with the bat in their hand. Guys that can play defense and take doubles away. And on the flip side, guys that can, play a little bit of offense and hit a double, actually hit it in the gap and run. So that's what we've looked for here. Our stolen bases, we've been right up at the top of the Sun Belt for a while, the last 2 years in stealing bases. And that's something we're going to need to do because speed travels as well. It's not just good at home, it travels. Have we been a little short in the power area? Yes. Last year, I think we hit 30 home runs, but if we played at and this is not a normal park, everyone will tell you, it in terms of other parks in our league, this one probably plays the biggest. So the home run numbers are a little deceiving. If we played at Georgia Southern, let's say, or Lafayette, you'd probably see a 25% to 50% increase in home runs. As far as what, 30 would probably turn into 45 or 50, which is a very respectable number. But last year, we've gotten some stronger kids, and I think we led the league in extra base hits. And I look at percentage of extra base hits to your overall hits. That's what really breaks backs, your extra base hits, your on-base percentage. So we look for guys that are strong enough to hit doubles that have home run power, but aren't necessarily going to hit 15 home runs. It used to be you hit 15 to 20 home runs, you were a power guy, and there was a lot of them. Now, 8 to 10, and you've got some power when they change the bats. The balls are a little bit more lively now, but at our park, if you hit 8 to 10 home runs over the course of a year, you've got some power. So I'm not going to put all my stock in guys that can hit it out of the ballpark. We need to play good defense, and we need to take runs away because nowhere on a stat sheet does it show we're a great outfielder. He might hit 3 home runs that year. Nowhere does it show how many runs they took away from the other team. So I'm into that as well. It's hard to quantify what a guy does. A guy hits 320 and 5 home runs and 40 RBIs, but he played great defense. Look at Cole Billingsley last year. Cole didn't have the year he wanted to have, and he's playing with the Orioles now, and he'll do exceptionally well because he's a great player. But he hit 300 and stole 30 bases. But some of the plays that he made in the outfield, he ended up with 35, 40 RBIs. When you try to quantify that, it's okay, he hit 335 RBIs. How many did he take away from the other team? It was like he drove in 55 runs. And so I look at things like that. I that's what I do. I look at guys that drive runners in and what they hit with men in scoring position. We try to recruit that. I look at the numbers. Stats are there. Numbers are there for you. It doesn't tell the whole story, but it tells you part of a story. You're bringing in an infielder that you see and he looks pretty good to you in one day, but you look at his numbers and he had an 890 fielding percentage. He made 19 errors at shortstop last year in junior college. You have to pay attention to that. It's your choice to pay attention to that or ignore it and just go off what you saw that day. I choose to pay attention to the past. Doesn't paint the whole picture, but it paints a better picture for you. And history tends to repeat itself. So we look for guys that have good numbers at where they are at, especially when they're in college, junior college. So and 50 to 60% of our guys are going to be from junior college. So we look at a body of work in terms of their 2-year stat total or 1-year stat total to help us decide whether they're good enough to play here or not. And we evaluate them, and then we look at their numbers and, we see if they're a guy with a high fielding percentage. Odds are if they fielded 960 in junior college, they're going to be a pretty solid fielder here. It gives me every reason to believe that they'll be a solid fielder here. But an outfielder that makes 4 errors, it gives me every reason to believe that he's not as solid a defender as we need. So I pay attention to the numbers. It's not the whole story, but it does tell us a lot about what we think the guy can be in the future. So But at this park, Brian, we're going to have to run, and you'll this year's no different. We're probably faster this year than we were last year. Potentially, we could have one of the fastest outfields, one of the faster outfields in the country, with if Hardy's in left and Swaggerty's in right and a Colton Thomas or Adam Wolf is out there somewhere in the outfield. Even Brendan Donovan, those kids can really, really run and go get the ball. So we're excited about what we have out there defensively. But that's what I look for when I recruit. It's you have to recruit to your needs, and then you have to recruit to your park as well. What plays at your park? You know, for us, a right-handed hitter that can get the ball up in the air a little bit would bode well. He'd have some success here because the wind blows to left in the spring. To have guys, big, strong guys in the outfield that can't really run a whole lot, to have three of them out there, that would not bode well for us because of the size of the gaps in the alley and the depth of the fence. So we recruit to really what we need year in and year out, and we recruit to the style of baseball we like to play, and both offensively and defensively.
So recruiting is a big part of what you guys have to do. And then your spring schedule, you start in mid-February, and in an ideal year, you run into mid to late June, and that's an extended period as well. I mean, between the two of them, how much time you spend on the road working versus how much time you spend at home? I don't think people understand, and your sport might be as bad as anyone in terms of the lifestyle and what you can do when you're in town with family and stuff like that.
The college baseball isn't one of the worst. It is the worst in terms of being gone. We live in a day and age where kids are specialized in one sport, and they play year round with travel ball. So, and then we have junior college, and their season's in the fall, and they play when we play. High school kids, they have fall ball. There's summer ball, and then they play in the spring. So it's never-ending. Our work is never really done. I know in the past month, you know, myself and my two – and Bob Keller and Chris Prothrow, me personally, I've been gone 15 out of the last 30 days down in Florida a lot. Bob's been – spent, you know, 8 days driving around Illinois, and he was there for 4 days the week before, and he was just in Dallas the other day, and Chris has been in and out. And so we're all going to pull about 15, 16 days on the road out of 30, 31 days this month. So, and that's just the fall. The summer, there's been times I've been gone for, you know, 13, 15, 20 straight days in a row where you're just living out of a bag. And, you know, you get to know the people at the hotel better than your own family sometimes. It is. If you're staying after it and you're working hard, there are certain sacrifices that you make. It's hard to have balance. But when you look at anyone that's great, I think you'd be hard-pressed to find somebody that in their heyday, whether it be a coach or a player, that had balance. You'd be hard-pressed, you know, to – I would say Nick Saban doesn't have a whole lot of balance in football season in his life. There are sacrifices that you make. And, you know, I'm not saying it's right. I'm just saying it's what the industry demands for you to be successful. I'm very fortunate. I've had my wife, we've been married, it'll be 24 years in December, and we started dating when we were 13, 14 years old. So my wife understands it. She gets it. It takes a special person, to really understand what we go through in this industry in baseball. So it's tough, but it's what you make it. You know, it's the time you have off. And I've learned as I've gotten older you know, when I'm off, I try to be off. And when I'm on, which is most of the time, it's you're going. So you have a small window. I don't want to do this into my 60s. I'm 48 now. And, you know, I guess my philosophy, whether it's right or wrong or indifferent, is, I guess, and I laugh all the time. I joke with my wife. I say, it's better to burn out than fade away. That's my opinion. So I'll know when I've had enough and, you know, when this has gotten to be too much. But right now I'm having a lot of fun and I have a great staff around me. And I understand it's, you know, I have some assistance with some small children and, I understand all that. It's different now than it was when my daughter Taylor was 3, 4, 5 years old. It was still a grind, but there wasn't as much going on in terms of youth baseball and travel baseball. So I understand it can get to be a lot. And there's time that you just have to say no. Hey, listen, I'm not going on this recruiting trip for this 4 days. I don't need to. We've done enough. and I'm going to go, I'm going to stay at home, and I'm going to be a dad. And, you know, there are times that you have to do that, because it can consume you if you let it in this business. So there are times where you have to think about that balance, and you have to try to have maybe balance that week. But overall, it's really hard. If you want to do uncommon things and you want to be successful, it's really hard balancing everything out to where you have enough time for everything, or you give enough time to everyone in your life. So I understand all that, and I'm very sympathetic towards that. And, you know, when we take our time off, it's time off. And when it's on, you know, we go pretty hard. But the most important thing is our families. And, you know, it's a game, and it's what we do. If you let it become who you are, which you can easily do, and I've been victim of that. I've been guilty of letting this thing become who I am. But as I've gotten older, I've learned how to separate the two, who I am and what I do. It's very important as a young coach to start to realize that at an earlier age. So, but, you know, ultimately, you want to win. You know, if you're competitive, you want to win. And the most important thing I do is recruit and hire people. And after that, the rest seems to fall in place. But if you have good people around you, you know, from a hiring standpoint and also from a recruiting standpoint, which I've been fortunate enough, I think I've hired really well, and I think we've done a really good job recruiting. And I think I've hired some people that, you know, it's about strengths and weaknesses, and having some people around you that are a little bit smarter than you in certain areas, and you might be smarter than them or better than them in certain areas. And it's about checks and balances and strengths and weaknesses. And I think we've done a nice job of that here in the last 5-6 years.
So, you know, anyone who would ask Dr. Erdman, you know, will tell you that the goals are Sun Belt championships. I mean, on the field and in terms of performance, but beyond just that kind of simple and kind of short term, year in, year out goal, long term, what do you hope for this program? What do you want to accomplish before the day comes when you decide that you've had enough?
Well, I would love to get back to the College World Series one or two more times or three more times. I would love that. Ultimately, Brian, it's about what these kids say about me and these coaches when they're my age, when they're 35, 45, 50 years old, when they're parents, when they're coaches, when they have children. It's about how they view their experience. It's about how they view the program. It's not necessarily about X's and O's. It's about how they were treated and what they learned, not just on the field but off the field. It really is. It's about life lessons that are learned. I'm into putting more into the guys than I take out. I really am. It's about caring about these kids. And, you know, I heard something a long time ago, and they you know, they'll care about how much you know when they know how much you care. And that's the truth. You'll have their attention when they really know that you care about them. And I've always gone into that recruiting and coaching and knowing that this kid needs to know I care about him before he'll even listen to me, because that's the way I was growing up. So, you know, these kids, we want a great experience for them. It's a big deal for them to choose South Alabama to come play for this program and this university. It's a big deal for us. It's an important thing for us that they get everything out of this that they can. And it's important that they look back and they see some of the lessons that they learned here while they were playing, whether they were good or bad, whether they were happy with my decision or they were unhappy, they realized that guy and those coaches, they had my best interest at heart. I could always go to them. They were there for me when this happened, or they were there for me when that happened. And it wasn't just, you know, they were a fan of mine when I was doing well, and they were a fan of mine when I was good, bad, when I played, when I didn't play, when I was younger, when I got older. It's a matter of doing the right things and being a great person, and that's what I think. That's what I think this program is all about. So ultimately, you know, when I'm done, I want the people at my, you know, reunion or my when I retire, when they show up, you know, if they show up. It's about what they say about you. It's about how you enrich their lives as well, not just on the field but off the field, and what kind of example and mentor you were to their lives, because they're paying attention and they don't forget, and they use some of the same lessons with their own children and players that they learned here. So this is a huge responsibility that we do things right, and because they're watching You know, it's a big responsibility. It's not just, hey, you can throw 90, go win some games for me, and we'll see you next week. It's their lives matter. They really do. These guys, they become – I don't have a son, but I always say I've had hundreds of sons over my career, and that's how I look at them. You know, they become part of your family, and you become part of theirs, and that's – you know, you're kind of there for them till the end, and that's how I look at it.
Coach, you've been very generous with your time this morning. We appreciate it. We're, as you would be on the field here in the spring, looking bottom of the ninth, you need to get three outs. Need some quick answers from you to get those done. You ready to take the mound?
Sure.
I know you said you don't have, you know, obviously there's not a lot of it, but when you have free time, what do you want to do most? What do you enjoy off the field?
I like, you know, my wife and I, and our daughter's 22 now, so and she's a senior here at South, but my wife and I, if I have some free time, we both enjoy to travel. Her and I grew up in South Florida. I grew up on the beach. I grew up on Marco Island. She grew up in Naples. So when we can, I like being by the water, which is why Mobile was so attractive to me 6-7 years ago. But I really do. I like being by the water, by the beach, and you know, that's what I like to do. And I'm lucky. My wife likes to do the same thing, so we have a common interest.
I was listening earlier. I think I could get this answer right, but outside of baseball, your favorite sport?
I'm going to have to say it's football. It is. I loved hockey, but, you know, coming up in Florida, you just didn't see a whole lot of it. And I started playing football. And football, really, when I can remember, that's – I just love the excitement of it. And I like the practices, and I like the tackling, and – I just, it's such a physical game, and there's so much work and time and dedication put into being good at football. Just not from not only just the strength conditioning, but from the coaching aspect of it, the time and the film study, and you know, the nuances of the game and the strategy of the game and the formations and things like that. I just have a lot of respect for the guys that are good at football that put the time in, especially the coaches as well.
For the record, I'm going to own up that I would have got that wrong. I was thinking hockey all the way, which I would have been very sympathetic with you on. That's my favorite sport, too. What's the best event you've ever attended as a fan?
Wow. You know, I'm gonna have to say, even though I was a participant, I was also – when you get to the College World Series, you're a fan of your team. You're a fan of other teams as well. And I never knew that until I got there. A lot of people asked me what it was like, and I said it was really strange in that you do everything in your competitive ability to get there, and you're trying to beat the team that you're playing that particular day. But when you get to the College World Series, you don't know if you're ever going to make it back. And I really, really mean this when I say this. I'm so fortunate that I realized this before I went. I went with my eyes open, my ears open, and I tried to take in as much as I could because I knew it might be the only time I ever get there. And so not only did I go as a participant, but I also, I became a fan. I became a fan of our own team and our own players. But I also went and I watched a lot of the other games. You know, I did some things. I took in the atmosphere. I took in a lot of things that you're supposed to take in that you can neglect, I guess, if it's your first time. You can get caught up in it and just be worried about winning the next game. But I went to a lot of those games as a fan. Now, I was scouting and I was watching some of the other teams that we might play, but the overall atmosphere and, you know, that's the only way I can answer that question. There is no event that I've been to. And I was at, you know, when the Marlins beat the Indians, I think it was Game 7 in the 90s, maybe 96, 97. I was at Game 7 in the World Series. And who can say they were at a Game 7 in the World Series? Major League World Series and actually that not be their favorite event, but the College World Series, I think it was because we were not just because we won it, but because I was a participant, but I was also a fan. I really was. And I don't know if that will be duplicated. Hopefully we get there again. And I don't know if that will duplicate the first time because it was such a great experience. And I just feel very, very fortunate that I was smart enough to take in a lot of things and not just be, you know, focused on our game, on our team, and you know, what we were doing that day at the park. I was able to walk around Omaha with my wife and daughter and go to the events and see the exhibits and just take in the fanfare. So that'll go down as my best event I've ever been to.
What sporting event that you've not been to is on the bucket list to get to in the near future?
I would really love to go to a Super Bowl. I would love to go to Super Bowl. Like I said, I love football. I like college football probably more than the NFL. So either the national championship game or the Super Bowl I'd like to attend.
Now, you said in your free time that you're a big traveler. What's the best vacation you've ever been on, best place you've been to?
I would have to say I love the Cayman Islands. My wife and I have been down there several times. Her parents used to live down there, and so we had a place to stay, and you know, not a bad place to go to, not a bad final destination. But I love the Cayman Islands. My wife and I scuba dive. I haven't done it in a little while, but I've been certified for 20 years scuba diving, and I actually got certified down there in the Cayman Islands. So I really enjoy that. It's just laid back. There's not a whole lot going on. No one's playing baseball down there. There's no one to go see. You just kind of kick back and enjoy yourself and just relax. And that's probably where I've had my most relaxing times is down in the Cayman Islands. So I'd have to say that's been my favorite place that I've gone.
And I'm sure that as travelers, you guys have some ideas, if not a full-fledged list of places you haven't been to that you want to go to. What's number one on that list?
Well, I'll give you two. I want to go to Yellowstone and Yosemite because I'm an animal fan. So I want to go out and see some of the animals. I really do, especially wolves. But I also, you know, I want to go to Africa. I really do. I want to go to Africa and I want to go to, you know, the Serengeti and Kenya and do the, I want to see the animals out there. And that's something that I am going to do. I hope I'm around long enough and, but, you know, that's something that's going to take 2 to 3 weeks, and it takes a while to get there and a while to get back. So I want to do it the right way. And I also want to go to Europe. My wife's on me. She's been there several times. My wife's been on me to – and my daughter's been on me to go to Europe. And so really, it's the three things. I want to see some of the national parks in the United States. And, you know, I want to – you know, I really – I want to do a tour. I want to, you know, go out to the Serengeti and see animals and and I want to go to Europe, but I want to do that right. I want to take a couple of weeks and just go out and, you know, rough it and travel around and take the trains and you know, see all the sights that are there to be seen.
I'm sure it'll be different and interesting to live out of a different kind of bag rather than going from motel to motel. What's your favorite movie?
Well, I have a couple. My favorite movie, Rocky I, just because it wasn't around the fight. Everyone thinks it's around the fight. Rocky II is around the fight. Rocky I was more character driven. It was more the person. You know, he was this kind and sincere guy that, you know, when you made him mad, it was all he could do was fight. And you had to get him mad to fight. And it just showed heart and determination and the things that, you know, a kid from the streets and had it rough and, you know, didn't really have his parents. But he had this heart of gold. He worked for the, you know, his day job was working for the mob and collecting money. And he couldn't do the job. He didn't have the heart to hurt somebody. He didn't have the heart to break somebody's thumb to get the money. But yet he had the heart and determination to become the world champion. And I know it was, you know, it's fiction, it's the movies, but the message and just, you know, who Stallone was as a person in that movie, the way they portrayed him, he just had a heart of gold and he was so nice to people. But he was as tough as they came too, and he just had to overcome a lot of obstacles. So that's my favorite movie in terms of, you know, serious movie. I love Shawshank Redemption, just the story. Forrest Gump is one of those movies that once you can come in the middle of it and you just sit there and you watch the rest of it. I love it. And, you know, the Naked Guns, I love Naked Gun. And I also, Tommy Boy is one of my, anything Farley's in, I love. And Will Ferrell. So I know I didn't answer your question directly, but I really do. I like movies, but I like some serious movies. I like Jack Reacher. I can't wait to go out and see the next one. The first one I thought was phenomenal, the action, and I like comedies as well. So that's, you know, those are kind of my go-to movies there.
Who's your favorite musical artist?
again, that's hard to narrow down because I'm such a fan of music. I like there's some great new music out now. My wife makes fun of me because it would not surprise her to get in my car and Billy Squier's on or Van Halen 1 from 1978. But I also like some of the new music as well. Our players roll their eyes. I'll put Van Halen radio on Pandora, and they're listening to AC/DC and Metallica, and they're like, oh my god. But I like Kid Rock, and I like some of the newer stuff too. I like some kinds of some forms of country and some artists in country, but I like rock and roll. That's hard rock. I like AC/DC. I like the Scorpions, Van Halen, old school stuff. I like some of that stuff.
I tell, when we have this conversation with my friends and a lot of them that don't like Van Halen, I'm not that far behind you in terms of age, but I'll argue that on Van Halen 1, when the horn comes in and then just the bass, it's about as strong an introduction to a band as that you'll get.
Oh, no doubt. Our players laughed. I have a Van Halen 2 concert t-shirt that I'll wear on the road, and our players are like, are you kidding me? Yeah, I have the Metallica t-shirt, and I'm no stranger to wearing the Van Halen 2 cover on my t-shirt. But I'm an old school rock guy. That's what I like.
All right. Last question. Two down, two on. Got to get them out. When they make the Mark Calvi story after your career is over, who's starring in the lead role as Coach Mark Calvi?
Oh, man. That's hard. That's a really hard – I don't know. I'd love to say Stallone, but because, I love Rocky. I don't know. I hope it would be somebody. I really do. I guess it's not necessarily who would do me, but I hope it would be somebody that they portrayed that was, good to others, that was kind, but was relentless and competitive and, understood the life's important things over what's important right now, kind of understood the long term. That's why I would hope that the director or producer would portray me as. Whoever played me, I don't think it would be a Justin Bieber type, but whoever the actor would be, I would hope that the way they'd drive the character traits would be that, just somebody that gave his all and cared about other people and, you could count on and was trustworthy and was a good friend. And that would be more important to me than who played me. It's how they portrayed me, I guess someone that just did things the right way and was relentless and took care of his friends and other people.
We've been visiting with head baseball coach Mark Calvi leading into the opening week of fall practice. Coach, appreciate the time so much this morning. Hope the fall goes well, and we'll look forward to seeing you out there on the field in the spring.
Thanks, Brian. I'm exhausted. I might go home and go to bed now. Thank you.
Inside Jag Nation is a production of South Alabama Athletics. Any rebroadcast or distribution of this podcast without the express written consent of South Alabama Athletics is strictly prohibited. Remember, you can find a new episode of Inside Jag Nation every week on usajaguars.com or have them automatically uploaded to your smartphone by subscribing for free on iTunes. Keep up to date with the Jags by following us on Twitter with @USAJaguarSports and @JagNationUSA. Thanks for listening, and go Jags!